This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, June 14th, 2016.
We first became aware of him in May of 2013.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
He was working as a contract security guard at a local courthouse, and he made some statements that were inflammatory and contradictory that concerned his coworkers about terrorism.
FBI Director James Comey speaking yesterday about Omar Sadiq Mateen. Was he a terrorist?
First, he claimed family connections to Al-Qaeda. When this was reported to us, the FBI's Miami office opened a preliminary investigation. And over the next 10 months, we attempted to determine whether he was possibly a terrorist.
Omar Sadiq Mateen, 29 years old, American citizen, angry young male, American citizen. Again and again, angry young male. But after questioning him in person twice in 2013 and 2014, the FBI determined that Mateen was no terrorist. Omar Sadiq Mateen was normal then, just an angry young man in a country of angry young men. And then he bought a gun, because in a nation where angry young men are free, there is nothing stopping the angry young men whom the FBI deems as normal from buying a gun. Might anything have raised a red flag or a redder flag to the FBI? Here's James Comey again.
We're also going to look hard at our own work to see whether there is something we should have done differently. So far, the honest answer is, I don't think so. I don't see anything in reviewing our work that our agents should have done differently, but we'll look at it in an open and honest way and be transparent about it.
One of the ironies of this whole investigation is that even if Mateen was determined to be a threat, and if he remained on those terrorist watch lists, he would have been able to go into a gun store and legally purchase the exact same assault rifle and handgun that he used on Sunday. Timothy Edgar reviewed terrorist watch lists under both the Bush and Obama administrations from 2006 to 2009. He's now a visiting fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute.
The terrorist watch list is just the comprehensive, consolidated list of everyone the U.S. government suspects of being a terrorist. And the way you get on it is if one of the nominating agencies, that's what they're called, the intelligence community or the FBI, has reasonable suspicion, that's the standard, to put you on this list. And for the FBI, that pretty much equates to being under investigation, which is why Omar Mateen was on that list a couple of times while he was under investigation by the FBI.
To extend the status of being on that list to also being unable to purchase guns, would that be a significant change in the consequences of being on a watch list?
Well, it would be a change. To my mind, it's a fairly obvious thing to do, just because being on the terrorist watch list already results in you having a number of inconveniences and even sort of what would otherwise be violations of your liberty, being given extra scrutiny at the airport or even not being allowed to fly at all, being denied certain kinds of licenses like a hazmat license. So to me, yes, of course, it's a consequence that people wouldn't like.
Does anyone, any court, evaluate the probable cause or the probity of the nomination process?
No, it does not. And the reason for that is this is just a watch list. It doesn't result in your being arrested or there being a search warrant or wiretap order against you. It's basically an information sharing system for the government. So you're just put on that list based on the agency's decision that you meet the criteria. There's an analyst at the FBI who checks that and decides whether or not the information against you is strong enough that it meets the reasonable suspicion test.
So there is virtually no due process in this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is not anything like the kind of due process that we normally expect in judicial proceedings.
So given that there's no due process and that a judge doesn't evaluate the nominating process, how can you justify taking away any rights from an individual who's on a watch list?
Well, sure. I think after September 11th, we put up with a certain amount of this kind of thing for counterterrorism programs. You know, one of the justices of the Supreme Court has said, you know, the Bill of Rights is not a suicide pact. When you have these kind of compelling interests to prevent terrorism, then you can take some steps that might otherwise normally not be okay. I certainly think that, you know, the courts are going to look at whether the process is fair, and there should be improvements made in the watch listing process. I think whether to have a watch list is in itself already in many ways a curtailment of ordinary standards of civil liberty. But the question is, once you've decided to go down that road and have that step, and use it for airport screening or license screening or other kinds of events, what sort of events should happen? And it seems to me that purchasing a gun is a pretty obvious one that you shouldn't be able to do if you're under reasonable suspicion of terrorism.
If you were going to have a watch list, you've already made the decision that you're going to have a watch list, why wouldn't you as well add restrictions that you can't buy a gun, you can't buy explosives, you can't get a hazmat permit, all these sorts of things?
Well, I think that's exactly right. Those are the things that make sense to have triggering the watch list hit. You know, if you have a watch list hit, you don't do that sort of thing.
Well, but why wasn't it done? Why wasn't it done?
Basically, the political power of the NRA and the gun lobby has prevented the government from adopting that sort of common sense step.
Although in terms of the mass shootings that we follow and the ones that we pay no attention to here in the media, it's a tiny, tiny minority of individuals on watch lists who are involved in these shootings. For instance, Adam Lanza in Newtown would not have been caught by a watch list weapons ban. And even if he had been on some sort of mental illness watch list, he could have just grabbed his mom's gun, which is what he did.
Well, certainly none of these counterterrorism measures are foolproof or, you know, necessarily going to stop every attack. For Adam Lanza or other domestic terrorists, there is the possibility of being put on a terrorist watch list, even if you're not connected to an international terrorist group.
Omar Siddiqui Mateen is a domestic terrorist, right?
Sure.
Okay.
Inspired by a foreign group. So these are efforts, you know, basically where the government, the FBI, the local police, other agencies need to improve their intelligence gathering and information sharing. This is just one system that allows you to do it.
Is it conceivable that Omar Siddiqui Mateen was notified that he was on a watch list?
Almost certainly he would have known that, having been questioned by the FBI. I don't know that he was notified specifically that he was on a watch list, but he certainly knew he was under suspicion by the FBI. And if you know anything about the watch list, you know that that's a likely consequence of being under investigation by the FBI for terrorism.
So here's a bit of speculation here, but it is a bit of a dramatic moment in the sequence of events that led to this horrible tragedy. When Omar went into the gun shop and purchased his weapon and waited for the background check to come back, do you think he expected to be allowed to purchase that gun, or that he expected to be caught and screened by the FBI?
I don't know how much people understand what that background check is and what's likely to result if you're under suspicion of terrorism. I guess we're having a lot of discussion about it now, so it might become relatively well known that even if you are on a terrorist watch list, you can still go ahead and purchase a gun. Certainly, ISIS has made the availability of guns in the United States kind of part of their recruiting message to would-be jihadists in the U.S. Hey, this is a great country. You can go out and get a gun very, very easily.
Well, at the very least, he probably went, no kidding. Look at that.
Yeah. I mean, this was a man who also was working as a security guard. So that's another question in terms of the watch list. Why wasn't his employer notified? Why wasn't the vetting process for becoming a security professional something that would be impacted by being on the terrorist watch list?
Given some of the details we're learning about Omar Siddiqui Mateen, is it possible that the FBI watch list is too narrow, that it basically says, oh, he said angry things, he talked about ISIS, let's look to see if he's funding or planning something specifically involved with ISIS, and it eliminates all sorts of other personal details in Omar's life that might have bore on the question of stress, anger, likelihood of becoming unstable in some way, in this particular case, his sexuality?
I think part of this is a sophisticated question about countering violent extremism and prevention. And the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security work together to create a program where they try to stop people from becoming radicalized. And that program, I think, has been somewhat successful, but it needs to be beefed up with further, more sophisticated psychology. and perhaps they would have understood that this person was particularly at risk and thought about strategies to prevent and intervene. And that's tricky and difficult to do, obviously, because you're looking at two different approaches. One is to try to develop a criminal case against someone for terrorism, including possibly using a sting operation. And the other is trying to turn him away from a very dark path. And those can be in tension with each other. In this case, perhaps the softer approach would have worked if they had done it in a more sophisticated way. But I think that's going to require a lot of effort to put together a program that would be more effective at countering these kinds of tendencies in young men who may be looking towards going down that kind of path.
Timothy Edgar, Senior Fellow in International and Public Affairs at Brown University's Watson Institute. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So now we know all about the violent, unstable, possibly mentally ill, inflammatory, dangerous fellow Omar Mateen. His ex-wife makes this charge, as well as former co-workers who also recalled him talking of killing people. Still, none of this caused him to fail background checks or screenings at the security company he worked for. In two separate interviews by FBI agents, he was questioned and released. Robert Chug is an assistant professor of criminal justice and forensic psychology at California State University, Long Beach. He's author of the book Mental Illness and Crime. Do we even use the words mental illness in what we know so far about this fellow, Omar Mateen?
Well, hello, John. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I think that that's a really great point. The telltale signs of mental illness haven't at least shown up yet, I believe, in this evolving media coverage. And this story is changing by the hour, literally from last night until this morning. And there's a couple new bits of information. But I don't see, other than perhaps a bit of paranoia and maybe gender identity issues, the telltale signs that we would associate with violence.
Well, before we get to the gender identity issues, go back for a moment to the Santa Barbara case, the shooting there where the individual had an angry manifesto that he published at the time of the shooting about how he had difficulty with women, that it turned him to actually hate them, and he hated anyone who had any sort of happy, normal sexual relationship. This anger, motivated by something that we find familiar, to produce an act that we find unfamiliar and completely out of bounds. Is there any way to track something like that?
Well, that's a really good point. I think with the Santa Barbara shooter, he was really, from a psychological point of view, compensating for like a very low self-esteem. He came across as very narcissistic, but probably found or thought about himself as being very small. And so the anger then becomes kind of a tool, and certainly the signs might show up along the way, and the loved ones and friends might see things that perhaps seem uncharacteristic, but then perhaps just sort of get swept under the rug. And then in the meantime, for the individual, the rage is building, and you know, like a snowball, and fueling itself, and eventually comes out.
So conceivably, there's a parallel development with the sexual identity questions that have been raised in media reports about Omar Mateen and the building anger, the low self-esteem, the kind of narcissistic tendencies that we saw in Santa Barbara being repeated here in a slightly different narrative.
I think there could be. I think you're making a great you're drawing a great parallel between this sort of inner conflict, where in Santa Barbara the conflict was between, you know, I feel worthless, I feel like nothing, so I have to build myself up, where in the Orlando case, maybe it's a fellow who is questioning his own gender identity and feeling very conflicted about it, and that's superimposed on this very sort of rigid faith-based system that it's incompatible, and so he's dealing with this inner conflict.
By pathologizing states of mind, is that going to get us any closer to some sort of pre-crime forensics that would help us to actually prevent acts like these? Or does it turn our society into some kind of Maoist inform on your neighbor sort of place?
I think certainly we can identify signs of mental illness early, and we can understand from a research point of view the connections between mental illness and various forms of violence and crime. Once we've established that, we can certainly look for, you know, moving forward proactively, the telltale signs of mental illness, and then perhaps be a little more proactive in our interventions without necessarily, you know, using the labels and the stigma that often come associated with them.
But barring a specific diagnosis, all we're really talking about here is criminalizing states of mind, which is Maoist.
That's right. And from a forensic point of view, you're really coming in after the fact, after the person has entered the criminal justice system, has been arrested or convicted of a crime. And so we certainly know, you know, retrospectively, the relationships between states of mind and criminal behavior. Moving forward, though, you're absolutely right. We do not want to stigmatize. We don't want to necessarily, you know, be like the Minority Report movie, remember, where we're proactively incapacitating, incarcerating people so that they don't commit future crimes. It's a very tricky and touchy subject. I think on one hand, we can't pretend it doesn't exist. And on the other hand, we can't go, you know, over the top.
Yet for young men and women in colleges, there are all kinds of initiatives to try to prevent teen suicide, where for the same kinds of reasons, the same kinds of tensions and anger, the violence is brought against themselves. So we view that as something worthy. Is it possible that in the United States, where we have no availability of mental health, we don't equate that with health care, we stigmatize mental illness and seeking help for mental illness, we celebrate the individual, and we have extreme availability of guns, that this is just a society where anger rules and guns are simply a tool for acting out that anger?
Well, we certainly have a culture of violence. I think that can't be denied. You know, now most young males do not grow up to do these sort of Orlando or Santa Barbara shootings. But the ones that do, you know, there's other factors certainly in play.
Can we pay attention to anger? Can we just pay attention to that, the various reasons why people might be upset and in pain in some way, and be, take a more, you know, for lack of a better term, Christian view of the whole thing? You know, I am my brother's keeper. I mean, in the old United States, extended families taught that you take care of people who seem to be lonely. Now we celebrate the individual, let them get angry on their own, and then worry about whether they were mentally ill long after they've killed 50 people.
That's right. I agree with everything you just said, and I would piggyback on that point by saying we also have this, through social media, I believe, this kind of disconnect from each other as human beings. I think that's, we're creating these rifts between us interpersonally that actually then isolate an individual and allow them to sort of, you know, seethe and that anger to kind of percolate. And to the other point, in terms of anger, I think we need to understand also anger is an emotion, and emotion is normal and human, and there are certainly appropriate ways to express anger and feel anger, and then there are inappropriate ways, and teaching people more of the former, right? That anger is okay, but this is how we express it, and this is how we deal with it. I think that can be learned at an early age, and certainly, you know, throughout the lifetime, be practiced.
People who are involved in criminal justice and psychology say that interventions work in suicide prevention. That if an individual is approached and there is a dialogue and a channel is set up, that it's remarkably effective in preventing problems. In this particular case, no intervention. Omar Mateen was left to go on his own. It's sad to think that even the simplest initiative would have prevented this, if possible.
In terms of suicide, I think if somebody really wants to take their own life, they will. And I would actually say that that extends into this conversation, where if someone really wants to commit an act like this, they will, regardless of however many interventions we put in place. However, putting the interventions in place, I think, dramatically reduces the likelihood of these things actually being carried out.
All right. So Robert Shugg is an assistant professor of criminal justice and forensic psychology at California State University, Long Beach. He's author of the book Mental Illness and Crime. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, working to advance cutting-edge research and cures, and committed to helping to make someday today for thousands of blood cancer patients. Learn more at lls.org. Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at curious.com/PRI. TIAA, whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. And LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Last week, residents in Hoosick Falls, New York, got the worst news from some blood tests. The tests found elevated levels of a chemical called PFOA in their bloodstream, sometimes 50 to 100 times the amount considered safe. PFOA is a component in waterproofing and non-stick substances used in everything from pizza boxes to waterproof jackets. Studies have linked it to diseases like cancer. The Department of Health apparently knew Hoosick Falls water was contaminated for more than a year before notifying the public. In this case, a direct echo of the water controversy in Flint, Michigan. And here's another echo. Local officials in New York did not notify local residents despite urging from the federal EPA.
It was hot, really hard in the beginning, probably November of this year. The EPA came out with a letter. You know, they were saying don't drink with it, don't cook with it. And yet the Department of Health was giving out a letter at the same meeting that we were at and saying that the chemical was completely fine and it's safe up to 50,000 parts per trillion.
That's Michael Hickey, a Hoosick resident who we spoke to back in February. Hickey tested the drinking water for PFOA after his father died of cancer. Now confronted with the proof from blood tests, there's no longer a question of contamination for all residents of Hoosick Falls. Lorene Hackett has just learned that she and her family have elevated levels of PFOA in their bloodstreams. Welcome, Lorene. How are you feeling right now?
I think we're more shocked and stunned. The worry sort of hasn't hit yet.
What's your doctor tell you about your own health, Lorene?
I've already had a lot of illnesses in my life. Immune suppression, bone issues, etc. I have not talked to my doctor about the number. I go see him this week. It's so not about me. It's so about our community and my grandchildren. My grandchildren's numbers were so, so high, and they're only 4 and 6. We don't know what the future holds for them.
You say your grandchildren's numbers were so high. Can you give me more specific details?
Sure. My 4-year-old granddaughter's number was 117. My grandson's was 142. And now mind you that the national average is 2.
Two. Oh, my goodness. And what about the body's ability to purge this chemical from tissues and blood?
I'm hearing the average that the half-life is between 4 and 9 years. But we're looking at 15 years if we're never exposed to it again for it to rid itself.
And what do your grandchildren know about what's going on?
They know not to drink the water. They will tell you that. They will tell you that we need good water. One of the things we're pushing for is an entirely new water source. We have temporary filters put on, but we're still drinking poison water through temporary filters. So a lot of people still aren't drinking the water.
And any thought of moving?
I have thought about it. For me, it's too late. You know, I'm a grandmother. I'm older. I've been dosed. I'll deal with that. For my grandchildren, I think my daughter's considering it, but, you know, it's costly. We're not a very rich community. We don't make a whole lot of money. So to uproot everything is emotional and costly.
In the last 18 months, some very prominent lawmakers and political figures in Albany have had to resign because of charges against them. Given the situation in Flint and the severity of that, do you think that this warrants the resignation of Governor Cuomo?
I don't know about that, but we are certainly Mr. Cuomo's Flint, and he has been trying to avoid that. I'm pretty sure it angers him, but it's the same concept. It's government being quiet and not sharing necessary information that is hurting people's health.
Lorene Hackett is a resident of Hoosick Falls who, along with her family, and particularly, as she was just telling us, her grandchildren, has elevated levels of PFOA in her bloodstream, a contamination from a factory in the local area.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, with packing, shipping, and moving supplies for both business and personal needs 7 days a week. Learn more at staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Thank you, New Hampshire.
This election is very important because our nation has a lot of crises in front of it, and we need somebody who understands how to make decisions.
I came out to vote because it's the first time in my entire life that there's an option of voting for a woman for president.
Hello, Louisville!
I'm
not really excited by the candidates, but I'm really feel this is an important election because I think there's a lot at stake right now.
Cruz, I think he wrote himself off. You know, that whole New York values thing.
God bless the great state of Wisconsin.
I just don't want Hillary. There's just something about her that I don't care for.
I've been a big fan of Bernie for years. I followed his career forever.
The choices we have today, I think, are actually real choices.
The great state of Ohio, I love you.
The primary this year was actually harder for me because I don't feel particularly drawn to either candidate.
It's like, oh, does it really matter?
I'm going to do this, this, this. I want them to understand. I want to be unpredictable.
I want to be like Donald Trump. I want a helicopter.
"40 acres and a helicopter," was that the slogan from Donald Trump in this wacky, crazy 2016 campaign that's all over? Look back there at the campaign, courtesy of our control room. But wait a minute. The nation's capital is dead last in the political contest season. There's one more primary. Democrats will head toward the polls today in the final presidential primary. Voters will vote, but unique in this election, this primary's results won't really matter. In normal years, lots of primaries don't really matter. James Lynch is a political reporter for the Gazette of Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, host of On Iowa Politics podcast, was among the very first voices we turned to in this election cycle when things kicked off with the Iowa caucuses at the start of February. James, you got two words for how things are looking now?
Buckle up, because we're about to experience turbulence.
So it's just getting started, you say?
Well, it's not just getting started, but it's kicking into overdrive, I think. Whatever we experienced during the primary, we're probably going to experience on steroids from here until November.
What do you think people in the state of Iowa think about the conventions and about where we go from here?
I don't know if there's a whole lot of interest in the conventions themselves, but I think there's a lot of soul searching going on. Republicans are telling me there's no way I can vote for Hillary Clinton, but I don't know if I can vote for Donald Trump. And conversely, I hear from a lot of Democrats who say there's no way I'd vote for Donald Trump, but I don't know if I want to vote for Hillary Clinton.
So Hillary has the task of making herself a sort of electrifying candidate again. It's among people who are very skeptical of her. And Donald Trump has to erase the skepticism that he's engendered over the last few weeks.
Exactly. You know, we love to say we're going to hold our nose and vote for the lesser of two evils. And what I'm hearing from voters is they're not sure who is the lesser of two evils or if there is a lesser of two evils this year.
What, looking back to February, surprised you most about the campaign?
Everything.
Yeah.
You know, we assumed that Jeb Bush's million-dollar fundraising apparatus would buy him the nomination, that by Super Tuesday, Hillary Clinton would have the nomination sewn up. This little-known socialist from Vermont wasn't going to put up much of a fight. So I would say everything about this campaign has surprised us. I think maybe most surprising is how surprising everything was. Just every development was like, oh, I can't believe this happened, and we've never seen that before.
All right, so we're just getting started. Do you think that favors Hillary Clinton or favors Donald Trump at this point, turbulence going forward before we quit?
I think it favors Hillary Clinton, and unless this really is a backlash election where people are voting their frustration, their anger with Washington, then that probably favors Donald Trump, definitely favors Donald Trump. However, I think as things stand right now, I think Hillary Clinton is probably the choice of most Democrats, probably I'm guessing, you know, maybe a majority of independents. And I think there's going to be some Republicans who are going to look at her and say she's a more reasonable alternative than voting for Donald Trump.
James Lynch is a political reporter for the Gazette of Cedar Rapids and Iowa City and host of On Iowa Politics podcast. Thanks so much, James.
You're welcome.
The gun as object.
It takes a lot of men to make a gun.
The gun that can be seen in museums.
Hundreds, many men to make a gun.
Commemorating America's violent past.
Men in the mines to dig the iron. men in the mills to forge the steel, men at machines to turn the barrel, mold the trigger, shape the wheel. It takes a lot of men to make a gun.
The gun that opened the West.
One gun.
The gun that settled the frontier are among the captions. It is a different history being examined by artists who are commemorating America's and the world's violent present. Here, Canadian artist Sandra Bromley has created The Gun Sculpture, an installation that was exhibited in Calgary, Alberta last year. Here is Bromley explaining how guns are used to make a composite of metal and wire that both neutralizes the guns but also amplifies their killing intent.
It's beyond my comprehension that people have the lust or desire to own these things. For what purpose? I mean, they're killing objects.
It's about like taking these parts of guns, etc., laying them on a table, and then if you see this, the shapes, it's more like a random or kind of a fortuitous serendipities. No, you find something that combines with this part and that part, and then you come up with a design.
Architect Pedro Reyes makes musical instruments out of guns in Mexico City to fight the violence in that nation's drug wars.
So I see Uzi here. You see Glockenspiel?
Uh-huh. Exactly. That's one potential use that we'll find for it. And these guns have killed more than once, no? It's, who knows how much suffering have they created. So it's like a feeling of taking that sheer might that the weapons have and making that into an instrument. It's very interesting because it's like the transformation is not only about the metal becoming like something different. There's like a kind of psychological transformation and a social transformation.
Peter Thum is the founder and CEO of Fondery 47 and Liberty United. It's an organization that collects weapons and melts them down and transforms them into necklaces, pens, cufflinks, and bracelets. It's something he's been doing for years in African nations that have been victimized by violence, genocide in Rwanda, sectarian murder in Burundi and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now Peter Thum is going after the guns here in the United States. He spoke to The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick.
I got into this field originally somewhat by accident. I had started and sold a company to Starbucks called Ethos Water, and which took American bottled water consumers' money and invested it in water projects around the world. I was visiting our water projects in Africa and met young kids with guns. Many of them were smaller than the guns that they were carrying. And that was the inspiration for me to try to take the AK-47, which is the most famous symbol of conflict in Africa, and turn it into something that was beautiful and positive. So we worked for a long time to get these kinds of guns out of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And when we did get them, we destroyed them, exported them, and then started making them into jewelry, watches, and accessories, and have used the sales of that business to fund a not-for-profit organization called Mines Advisory Group that works out of the UK that is also a Nobel Peace Prize-winning organization, which does small arms and light weapons destruction work in concert with governments in the United Nations. And we have funded programs specifically in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Burundi, and in the last 5 years destroyed north of 50,000 assault rifles there.
Pounding guns into art. How much money have you raised and been able to put back in?
Well, the way that it works is that every piece that someone purchases funds the destruction of a specific number of weapons. A very simple example of that would be when we sell one of our watches, which are a limited edition mechanical Swiss watch that's very rare. We're only making 20 of them. The purchase of that watch funds the destruction of 1,000 assault rifles, and then we provide the serial numbers of all the guns to the purchaser.
Describe some of this art to me. What can I buy? What sculpture can I buy? Obviously, I want it to invoke the look of an AK-47 so that I know that I'm involved in a cause. Or what does a watch look like?
I can give you some examples of the things that we've made. We formed a partnership with the Cross Pen Company and have created a line of limited edition fine writing instruments that we're already selling through Fondery 47 and through Cross. And soon we will be introducing a much more scaled line where we'll be able to reach thousands of people with a more affordable version of this pen.
So in this case, an appeal obviously to very wealthy people who would want to help with a cause anyway. They can write a check to a charity, or they can have some symbolism. They can have a possession that sort of symbolizes their activism.
the way that we built this was very intentional. We wanted to make things that got attention from people who are powerful, who with a stroke of a pen can change something significantly. And we have two options. We have a company that produces these things and sells them in partnership with famous and very accomplished designers. And then we have a not-for-profit organization that is called Foundry 47 Foundation. So we have received donations from people who maybe aren't interested in buying something but understand and want to support what we're doing.
Is it therapy in a way for all of those people who feel helpless about a problem that frustrates them? Or is it real practical results from their view, do you think? Do they view getting involved with you as saving 7, 8, 9 lives or getting 2,400 guns off the street? Or do you think it's that? Do you think it's a way for people to feel less helpless and say, this problem is awful, but I was able to do something instead of fret about it?
Maybe it's all of those things for some people. It's different things for some people. So some people may feel that it's a very practical thing for them. Some people may feel that it's therapeutic. Some people may feel that it's both. I think in very real terms, in Africa, we've taken nearly 55,000 assault rifles out of circulation when at the very beginning of that project, people told us we'd never get one. And that is no simple task. If you were to see a stack of 55,000 assault rifles, it's an enormous amount of weaponry. Here in the United States, we've funded programs for kids, at-risk kids in very violent neighborhoods, north of 1,700 children so far. And so these are children living in neighborhoods that have gun violence levels that are at the same level as the most dangerous places, countries in the Western Hemisphere. And so kids in the south side of Chicago living in Inglewood, the murder rates there are equal to those in places like Guatemala and some of the most dangerous places facing gun violence in Mexico. And I think that's very hard for people to understand if they live in a safe suburban environment where they never see any of this. And so I think to some extent also it's really important to give people a sense of connection to people they may never meet and to give them a physical example that they can both speak about but also that connects them to people who may not necessarily stand out because of the fact that if you turn on the television today, we see news about gun violence every day and news about the kinds of events that have prompted us to sit down today, like the one in Orlando, happens so frequently that I think it's like wallpaper now. The fact that people can see that and then very quickly go back to their normal daily lives means that the things that are happening right now in order to try to stop this and make change are not sufficient.
Peter Thum is founder and CEO of Foundry 47 and Liberty United. For more information on Peter Thum's jewelry, including links, head to thetakeaway.org. And just to put the button on the end of this story, here's something to take with you today. Some final details that are no longer a surprise. Gun stocks are rising in the wake of the shooting in Orlando, and sales of the AR-15 assault rifle, once again, soaring. Deals online begin at around $600. Ammunition not included. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.